Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with critically acclaimed author, MacArthur genius, two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, Tony Award-nominated playwright and author Sarah Rule, about her new book, Lessons from My Teachers. It's an essay collection based on her popular class at Yale. It's a meditation on the life-altering bonds between teacher and student and the wisdom imparted both inside and outside the classroom. Sarah Rule is a playwright, essayist, and poet. Her 15 plays include In the Next Room, The Clean House, and Eurydice. Her book, 100 Essays I Don't Have Time to Write, was a New York Times notable book. Her other books include Letters from Max with Max Ritvo and 44 Poems for You. Dreams All Dream Tonight is her debut picture book. She teaches at the Yale School of Drama, lives in Brooklyn with her husband, Tony Chaturvastra, who is a child psychiatrist, and their three children. You can find her at sarahruleplaywright.com. Sarah Rule, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, really enjoying the book, and I just want to read from the introduction. You say, I went through a dark period. The world had shrunk to the size of a phone. And as if though the phone could answer all of the kinds of questions, but you found it only had loud opinions. I thought that was very apt. I think a lot of us have gone through that period. Tell me about that.
Well, I think there's been so much turmoil in the world, and I think I reacted to it by looking to see what notable people had what opinions on which website and which news site. And I found that all my anxiety led to one moment before bed where I was kind of lying down with my phone in the dark, kind of scrolling around looking for wisdom, and then thinking, God, how absurd. I'm isolating myself. I'm not in dialogue, and I'm not in relation to, in presence with another person trying to sort this stuff out. And so writing the book in a way became a cure for my own, I suppose, loneliness and despair about the state of the world.
You say your son, when he was younger, used to ask Siri, you know, questions that we all have. That's probably good for a, you know, mother of a three-year-old or something, but you say when he became eight, he started asking Siri the meaning of life. And that's probably the limit of Siri, right? I don't know what the answer was.
With ChatGPT, I'm sure you have all kinds of existential questions being asked by all kinds of people all day long. And that was kind of the harbinger to me. Was first my son William would be asking, like, oh, you know, what is oobleck, or how fast can a cheetah run? And then when he got to what is the meaning of life, I thought, oh, I need some better guidance for him.
I was very interested to see, because I try to wean myself off technology, you know, usually with it's a failure. You say you put your phone on grayscale to try to get yourself away from that. And then you ask yourself, am I addicted to the color of information?
Well, it's so bizarre. It's a technique someone said worked, and it does work. It makes your phone less alluring to have it in grayscale. But then eventually I'll think, oh, I need to take a picture and I want to see what color this picture is. And so I bump it back. I must say, right now I'm having some pretty good success with an app called Zen Screen, and you can block different websites. It only lets you open them like five times a day, and you can put time limits on, and it just creates that little pause. And then it sort of says, why am I checking, or why am I looking? So it gives you one moment to be conscious of the fact that you're doing it.
Zen Screen, I'll have to try that. Yeah, I'm always looking for something. That sounds promising. You say in your introduction that you got thinking about your teachers, not just in a disembodied source of information, but embodied teachers. And you came to this key that it's the relationship that's the key.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating that in our digital landscape, you know, we have all these videos on YouTube about how to do things, how to cook things, how to make things, or you can go on masterclass and theoretically take a course with a great poet. And these amazing kind of famous people teaching on masterclass, which is so incredible. But what it removes from the moment is what I think what's most valuable about teaching in a way, which is proximity, relationship, the exchange. There's no exchange. It's all, everything you get is going to be unidirectional. And that's, I don't think, where you get the most powerful kinds of teaching, where it's sometimes the most random thing a teacher says or does, maybe by example, that gives you this massive insight, or just watching how a teacher offers to buy you a cookie because they're concerned for your welfare, you know, little acts of kindness that cement a relationship over time. And you just don't get that by trying to figure out on YouTube, you know, how to cook spaghetti bolognese.
And it's a relationship, it's two ways, right? You also write, the more you teach, the more you learn.
Yeah, and I've had extraordinary students who've become my teachers. You mentioned Max Ritvo, who was one of my students, who I wrote a book with, and he was an extraordinary poet who I met when he was a senior at Yale, and he had a recurrence of Ewing sarcoma, and just a brilliant, brilliant writer. And we got to be good friends, and he taught me huge, huge lessons about how to die, how to write, how to be demonstrative.
Well, let's jump in. You have these essays, each one based on I guess a teacher, right? Start with the first one. For my first teacher, my mother. I was struck. You paint her very well. You talk about a conversation you had when she was, I guess, in her 50s. You were in your 30s, and she seemed a little down when she called you. And it was because she was wondering about her legacy. Did she really have a legacy?
Yeah, my mom, who is still alive and still acting a little bit in Chicago. She's 82, and she was a high school English teacher for a long time, and went back and got her PhD at some point. But she was down on herself for, you know, a considerable amount of time, because she felt she hadn't accomplished enough in life, or hadn't sort of had a plan and hadn't set out to do a particular thing. And it made me sad, because I think she's such an extraordinary person, has affected so many students, and also me and my sister so profoundly. So the first essay is really thinking about my mom and all the lessons she's taught me.
You mentioned she was an actress, so you spent a lot of time, I guess, in theaters. What did you learn from that part of her life?
Well, I loved it. I mean, I didn't have a babysitter, and so if she was directing something or acting in something, and she didn't have a sitter, she would take me along, and I would sit in the back and I would watch, and I thought it was really glamorous, for one thing. But I also learned so much about actors and how they're in a state of play and how they manage to remain present and in the moment despite having to repeat things over and over and over again. And I guess that could be when I caught the bug initially to go into the theater.
Definitely an influence, right? To directly influence your life.
A deep influence. My mom also grew up playing Peter Pan in Davenport, Iowa. She did community theater. And so when I was little, there were all these pictures of her in tights flying in the house. And I really associated her with this mythic landscape of the theater, you know, a place where you could fly. And Mary Martin came through town at some point on a press junket in Iowa. And the local paper wanted to photograph my mom, the local Peter Pan, with Mary Martin. And I guess my mom left her script behind, and Mary Martin sent it back signed with flowers. And so at one point I wrote a play for my mom called For Peter Pan on her 70th birthday. And part of it was wanting to give her a gift as she was grappling with these questions of mortality and legacy.
I was struck by, you know, I'd like to talk about all the essays we can't, but the principal who once seemed fearsome. I think we've all had these experiences, right? People who seem larger than life, and then, and then they're not.
Right. To a kid, they loom so large. I had this principal, Principal Nielsen, and I think I got in trouble once at a food fight. And I felt he was being very unjust to me because I'd only thrown a single French fry that had been thrown at me. And he kind of bellowed at me, and I felt ashamed. And it was only after he died that I learned in his obituary what a heroic presence he'd been when a little boy with HIV had first come to our school. And there was some resistance in the community when people didn't know much about AIDS or how it was transmitted. And he handled the situation so beautifully, not disclosing the identity of the child to the community or to the teachers who weren't caring for the child. And you know, this little kid ended up dying, I think in sixth grade, and they planted a tree out front, and he was really beloved in the community. And it was this softer, gentler side of this man that I hadn't known about, because I only saw him as this fearsome arbiter of justice, you know, at food fights.
I'm gonna skip all the way to the epilogue right now. Of course, we'll loop back, but I think one of the big messages of the book, there's a lot of lessons in here and a lot of things to chew on. One of the things I think you would want people to do is to thank your teachers, right? Thank them while they're still alive. I want to read this line. You say, so often we absorb teachers in our minds just as we absorb our childhood. They become ours, bizarrely disembodied, not people to whom we might write a letter or bring a gift. You're saying, let's write letters, let's bring gifts.
That was one of the big lessons I had from writing the book, and one that I didn't know from the outset, but I made a practice of sending each essay to each teacher as I went. And it was pretty humbling to realize, first of all, that a lot of those teachers hadn't been thanked much, that they don't get very many thank you letters, that they don't know the impact that they've had. And also, you know, three of them died not long after I had sent them the letter or sent them the essay. And so sometimes you think this window you have to thank your teachers is long, and you'll get around to it at some point. And sometimes the window is smaller than you ever would have imagined. So I do think the book made me really want to run out and tell everyone who has a beloved teacher, you know, don't wait, call them now, send them a letter now.
One of your teachers said that teachers teach everything all the time. And I guess you're teaching by example, right? Your actions, even when you think you're not teaching, you're teaching.
Exactly. And this friend of mine is a wonderful elementary school teacher. Her name is Sarah Curtis. She used to babysit for my kids. And she said, teachers teach everything all the time. And she went into some detail then talking about how when it's time for a lesson on the rug, and they're saying kindergarten or first grade, you might think that the main thing you're teaching is the lesson on the rug, but in fact, you're also teaching them how to come sit on the rug because they don't know. They're in school for the first time. So I think that's true even as you get into college, and your college professors are teaching not only the content, but how to be a human being and how to be in engagement with the world.
I said at the beginning, it's in the, you know, the blurb for the book, this, you started thinking about all of this as you're teaching your course at Yale. Tell me about that course, what you're trying to teach.
So I started teaching this course, Lessons from My Teachers, about a decade ago. And the reason I started teaching it was that I didn't want my playwriting students to think there was one way to learn how to write a play, and that only I had the access to it, or that I didn't want my students to think that I wanted them to write like I wrote. I wanted them to write how they wrote, and to give them sort of multiple entry points. I thought, I'll teach them four writers who've taught me, and I'll try to teach their work, but also their pedagogy and how they taught and the exercises that they gave me, thinking each student might have a favorite entry point. a way in that I myself couldn't necessarily provide, but one of my teachers might be able to provide. So it was a way of being close to my teachers and acknowledging the effect they had on me, acknowledging that we take artists as being, you know, originals, I think, too often, rather than thinking about legacy and lineage and the fact that they don't just arrive out of the desert. They often have profound influences.
You say that while you're writing this book, you tend to have conversations with friends and acquaintances. You'd ask them, who is your most important teacher? What do they tend to tell you?
They told me all kinds of things. I mean, I'd hear about martial arts teachers, preschool teachers, neighbors, mothers, fathers, children. But I also would hear sometimes, you know, I didn't have an important mentor. And I would hear people reflect on why they thought that was. Was it luck? Or was it that they didn't make themselves vulnerable enough to really pursue mentorship? Because I think in a way to kind of wave your hand to a teacher and say, like, I want to be taught, requires a certain kind of bravery also.
If you just joined us, we're talking with playwright and author Sarah Rule, and her new book is a very interesting book. It's called Lessons from My Teachers. It's an essay collection based on her popular class at Yale, Meditation on Life-Altering Bonds Between Teacher and Student, the Wisdom Imparted Both Inside and Outside the Classroom. We'll take a brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. We're back with Sarah Rule. She's a playwright, essayist, and poet. She's a critically acclaimed author, MacArthur Genius, two-time Pulitzer finalist, Tony Award-nominated playwright. And the new book is called Lessons from My Teachers. So, Sarah Rule, let's talk about your sister next. You became a playwright. She became a doctor, I think, right?
Yeah.
I just want to quote with this. Things my sister taught me. How to funny phone call your bully. That makes me like your sister already. She taught you that most things are funny, like literally almost everything, if you look at them askance. Most fun does not require planning. This is just one of the bullet points here. Tell me about your sister.
My sister is such a delight, and she is so funny, and she is so, her sense of humor is so unexpected, and she's strong, and she, you know, really looked out for me when I was a kid and continues to. And we have very separate paths. She's, you know, she went into the sciences and is a geriatric psychiatrist and helps people every day. And I do what I do. But we have such a kind of mutual admiration society, I think, for each other's sense of humor and imagination.
You have a chapter on, I guess, an early influence, Joyce Piven. I guess if you wanted to be in the theater world in the Chicago area, you went to her, I guess, her studio where she taught. And you say she didn't really care as much about talent. I'll quote you. She cultivated talent where she saw it, acting, writing, or simply being a person.
She was an extraordinary teacher. And Joyce is someone who I lost this year. And I met her when I was 12. I went to her theater school, really, I think, as a way of being less shy. And they teach improvisation there. And she really, you know, did. She and her husband, Byrne, trained a whole generation of Chicago actors, the Cusacks and, you know, the Jeremy Piven and, you know, tons of others. But I think what she cared most about was forming a community and giving kids the tools to play and to be authentic. And I think even more so now, God, it's so important. I just think kids are so socially isolated and don't really know how to be with each other, some of them. And for kids who aren't into sports, theater is a huge life-changing activity where you can be in community with other people and learn how to play.
In the title of this chapter is how Joyce taught you how to listen. I just want to read this. She would say, nothing's more beautiful on stage than somebody really listening. Tell me about that.
So Joyce would always say, when you're on stage listening, you have to not be thinking about what line you're going to say next. You have to be not judging yourself or outside of yourself. You have to be really listening and focused on the other person. And you wait until they're done with their line to react, rather than cutting them off or thinking, you know, they're talking. Now I say my thing. And so we don't often train people to listen. So Joyce would really teach people how to listen. And I realize how rare that is now. I mean, I wish we could all take a crash course on how to listen and how to listen deeply and empathically and listen without thinking about our response, but really, really listen.
You have an essay here about your father. Again, sounds like a great character, right? Great father. You say he taught you a new word every week, and that ritual was holy to you. Like what words?
So we would go to this pancake house, and he would try to stump me with a word that I didn't know. And so he picked hard words. Peripatetic was one, ostracized, defunct. He liked words where he could teach me the etymology so that there would be like a little story associated with the word.
So a certain point, way too early, he was diagnosed with cancer, right?
Yeah.
So you used your frequent flyer miles from a friend to go home frequently, but he didn't necessarily like that. He wanted to just have you stay at school, I think.
Well, he wanted me to have a normal, quote unquote, college experience. And of course, nothing was normal about it because he was diagnosed with cancer my freshman year when, you know, he was 51 and it was, you know, October for me. So it was sort of just the moment where you're supposed to separate and fly away. And I wanted to do nothing but be home. But I think he knew that being home and watching him suffer was going to be hard on him and hard on me. So I kind of pulled up my big girl pants and tried to get through school and come home as often as I could.
You say he refused prognostications, didn't want to put a number on it. And maybe because of that mindset, lived longer than the doctors would have given him to live.
It is kind of amazing. Yeah. We knew he had stage 4 cancer. We knew it was everywhere, but he didn't ask for any predictions. And he lived for 2 years doing, you know, experimental radiation. I mean, it would have been so much better now, the treatment, but I learned later that they thought he only had 6 months and he had 2 years. And because he was so gracious and lovely and brave, there were some really wonderful moments, I think, in that 2 years.
You write that your father loved his children without conditions. And you wonder, is that just innate or do we learn that?
I do wonder how we luck into that capacity to love without conditions. I mean, certainly I think it helps if we were loved that way. It's hard to love people without conditions, but what a gift. Mm-hmm. What a gift to give and receive that kind of love.
Really touching. You apparently took a scrap of his handwriting, put it in your wallet after he died. What were you, I guess, keep him close, I guess?
Yeah, his handwriting was very specific and just made me think of him. It was like, you know, this thumbprint. It just was, I saw his handwriting and it was just like, oh, that's my dad. So I used to carry this handwriting around with me when I was scared to do something, like when I flew on an airplane. And funnily enough, I wrote a play called Eurydice that's having a revival at Signature Theater in New York right now. And I made an opera version of it. And we had these projections, and it's a play about my father. And the projection designer actually said, let's make a font for your dad's handwriting. Do you have his handwriting? I said, well, sure. So she actually created this digital font based on his handwriting and then projected at large. And there was my father's handwriting on the wall of the Metropolitan Opera, which was completely surreal.
So I was very interested to learn about that. I'm an opera buff myself. What was that like writing? You took the play, made it into a libretto, collaborated with a composer. Tell me about that process.
Yeah, it's this wonderful composer, Matthew O'Coin, and he had wanted originally to write an Orpheus opera, and somehow he learned that I'd written this play, Eurydice, and we got together, and mostly I condensed the play because it takes so much longer to sing a line than say a line. So I didn't change it a huge amount, but made it more singable in certain areas, made it shorter, and maybe tried to bone up the structure a little bit. But weirdly, it was already written in a 3-movement structure as though it had been written for music, even though I wasn't thinking about that at the time.
Has it been produced yet?
Yeah, it was done. It was done at the Met, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And then Boston Lyric Opera did it and Grand Rapids Opera. Matt worked on a kind of smaller scale version for a smaller orchestra because, you know, the Met has such a massive scale and orchestra that he wanted it to be able to produce at smaller opera companies.
What was that like? See your words sung instead of said.
Oh my God, I loved it. It's addictive, I think, is what it is. Because, I mean, those singers in a small room, the power of those voices is really something. So I'm worried that I've caught the bug.
might be more opera from you. Well, that's all to the good. You talk a little bit about in the book about the thrill of seeing your words on stage for the first time, going 3-dimensional, I think is how you phrase it. Tell me a little bit about that. What was that first play?
It was called Passion Play, and it was about a little town in Elizabethan England that does the Passion Play every year. And in some of those little towns, the guilds would handle different parts of the Bible story. And like sometimes if your family was like the fisherman's family, then they'd get the role of Christ. And if your family was, I forget who played Pontius Pilate, like what guild would have that role. But anyway, it passed down through families. So it was about, in a way, it's about typecasting and about an actor who wanted to play the role of Christ who always got cast as Pontius Pilate. So Paula Vogel, who was my teacher, snuck the play into a new plays festival in Providence, along with graduate students. I was an undergraduate at the time. And it was a dramatic story the opening night because my mom had come to visit to see the play. And we were driving, we had an accident on Hope Street and someone blindsided us and crashed into us. And I hit my head on the ceiling of the car. And afterwards, we were so shocked, and the other car got out. Oh God, you know, the car was dinged up. And my mom said, do you want to go to the hospital and get an MRI? And I said, no, we got to get to the theater. You know, we got to get to opening night. So we went to opening night, and I think it was so out of body because it was almost like I'd had a near death experience on the way to the play. And then just seeing the actors embody the story and seeing the audience take it in is also such an out-of-body experience. And there was a big standing ovation. And I think that was that moment where I was like, oh, yes, this is what I want to do.
So Paula Vogel, you have an essay on her, obviously. She's your I guess, your main mentor, very influential in your life. Very interesting how she guided you on how best to write about grief, right? You wanted to express your grief about your father's death. And she said, I want you to write a play in which a dog is the protagonist. What was she doing there?
She was trying to get me out of my head and trying to get me to not look at the grief directly, but to trick myself so that I was focused on some other task. So I ended up writing a play where the family dog was waiting for, you know, his master to come home from the hospital, and he never comes home. So it was a way of dealing with my father's grief, but not looking at it directly. And it was such good advice. And I give it to my students all the time, because I often find there's maybe a really important experience they want to make into art. But if you go about it too directly, sometimes the alchemy just doesn't happen. You have to kind of squint a little bit.
How do you, you've said in another essay that you feel like the theater is a good place to process grief. Why so?
I think because it's a ritual space and you gather people together and they're ghosts. You know, it's a kind of a place of ghosts. It's a place where the present exists alongside the past in a funny way. You know, like if you do a Tennessee Williams play, you're doing the play, but there's a sort of the ghost of Tennessee Williams and his mother around. There's sort of the ghost of all the other actors who've embodied it. And I guess I don't mean literally that there are ghosts wandering around, but there are these invisible impressions that are sort of still in the ether. And you have catharsis, you know, in a perfect world, you know, in the way that Aristotle described it. You project your own experience onto the experience of these amazing avatars, these actors, and you hopefully can have a release of grief.
You, one more thing about Paula Vogel, you say the thing that really struck you, what you remember a lot, maybe the most, is her presence. So maybe what we were talking about before, which you wrote earlier in the book, you know, masterclass is fine, but you really need presence to make that relationship work.
I mean, Paula, when I was a graduate student, she invited us out to Cape Cod, me and three other graduate students, where she has a house. And she said, I want you three to look out at this view of the ocean and say to yourselves, this is what playwriting can buy. You know, it's so funny, but also so inspiring and empowering. You know, she'd won the Pulitzer Prize for How I Learned to Drive, and she bought this house in Wellfleet, Massachusetts. So she was saying, look at this view. She was giving us the view. So that's one thing. She was allowing us to see the beauty that she saw. And she was saying, you can do this too. That's extraordinary. I mean, that's something a masterclass is not gonna give you.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to be talking today to playwright and author Sarah Rule. Her new book is Lessons from My Teachers. We'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with critically acclaimed author, MacArthur Genius, two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, Tony Award-nominated playwright and author, Sarah Rule. Her 15 plays include The Next Room, The Clean House, and Eurydice, several books, including a New York Times notable book, her book, 100 Essays I Don't Have Time to Write. And she's joining us from Brooklyn. The new book is Lessons from My Teachers. Well, we shouldn't leave out your husband. Lessons from a Marriage. And I want to just read this open. I like this. You say, I could lie and say the reason I can write and have three kids is sheer force of will or my excellent time management skills. It's neither. It's because I married a feminist. I'm now going to issue a warning. If you are annoyed with your husband, wife, or partner right now, don't read this. Then you go on to highlight your husband's sterling qualities. What have you learned from your husband?
Oh my God, so many things. He's a very wise person, and he and I are very different the way we move through the world. I mean, I think one thing we have in common is that our jobs involve listening. He's a psychiatrist, so he listens all day and listens to how people make stories of their lives. But he's more practical than I am. He's more scientifically minded than I am. And so I've had to learn from him so many things about just the shape of a day, how to load a dishwasher, how to, I talk about one fight we have about clearing the table, how and when to do it. We also have fights about how many utensils you should lay at the table at every meal, because you know I'm from Illinois, and it's common in my household just to have a fork. And he's like, you always have three utensils. What is this, only a fork situation? You know, so we learn from each other all the time. And he's really, we've grown up together, and I value so much that he's not threatened by my writing. He does so much to facilitate my having time to write and be a mother, and I'm so grateful for it.
I love this I love this essay, but the title "Giving Your Kids Your Divided Attention" goes against the conventional wisdom. You say, I think I get the most emotional information from my kids when I give them my divided attention. How so?
Well, I think it's a funny thing about kids that they sometimes will tell you the most when you're driving and, you know, you're not looking at each other, and suddenly they'll spill out what's bothering them at school, or if you're doing the laundry or something, they start talking to you. But if you're kind of like on them and, you know, interrogating them when they're teenagers, they won't tell you anything. So I don't know. I found that fascinating. The older they get, that the more we do a kind of parallel activity, the more I get from them.
What have you learned from your kids?
Oh, my kids. I have three kids, Anna, William, and Hope, and they're all very different. And they too teach me how to be present all the time and how to love unconditionally. And they're all very wise, each in their own way. God, it's hard for me in a way to reduce it down. But I have some little lessons, I think, from each of them in the book.
I was especially interested in the essay on critics, lessons from critics. You say, I guess your first bad review, which I think might've been on your first play.
Yes.
you say you responded by taking an empty glass of Smucker's jam into the basement and smashing it onto the floor, and then resolving never to read another review again. Have you changed that perspective? Where are you at now?
You know, I still don't read them because they still have the power to hurt my feelings or keep me from writing the next play. I'm waiting to be enlightened, to really be an enlightened being where I can read them and not have my feelings hurt, and not have it interfering with writing the next play, but I'm not quite there yet. So I still don't read them, but I probably miss some valuable insight in so doing. But you know, it's funny, my mom will read my reviews and my agent will read my reviews, so they'll tell me if there's something I should really pay attention to.
You said, I think you have this in this chapter, years later, you went to dinner with this critic.
I did. It was incredible. We had such a good conversation. And what was incredible was, it kind of goes back to Joyce Piven, who had directed that first production. And Joyce and I had been fighting about this one artistic choice in terms of casting. And the critic had kind of thrown me under the bus in the review for the choice, but it actually was a directorial choice. And so years later, I was able to say, you know what? I actually agreed with you. I've been fighting for that choice. And he was like, oh, interesting. And he wrote like the tiniest retraction of it years later, which was so interesting. I mean, I think critics, you know, are always, they're coming to a play with deep, hopefully, curiosity and an attempt to get the context right, but they're not there for the process, so they can only speculate about it. And a play is such a, it's like it's presented as a whole organism, but there's so many parts that keep it afloat, and critics sometimes just get it wrong, try as they might.
Underline this part in this chapter. You say, I do not take for granted my resilience or that of my students. You say, let me get this here, our resilience must be practiced, bolstered by our friends and our teachers. This idea of resilience, you can build up that muscle, I guess.
I think you can, but sometimes you just want to cry and never write again. And then you call your old teacher, and she'll say, if it was Joyce Piven, she'd say, don't let the bastards get you down. I don't know if you can say that word on public radio. Is
Yeah,
that what?
I believe that word we can, yes.
You cannot?
We can, yes.
Yeah, because okay, I could
Yeah.
replace it. Yeah, so Joyce would say that, and some friends make you laugh and make you, they laugh you out of yourself and out of your self-absorption. And sometimes they just need to pick you off the floor, peel you off the floor if you've had a really terrible day, and encourage you. So I don't take it for granted. I think duration in show business in particular is, it can be brutal. It can be hard knocks. New York can be really hard knocks. So you do need to surround yourself with people you trust.
Just a minute or two left here with Sarah Rule. This is intriguing. You have an essay titled, "Can You Be Your Own Teacher?" What do you say?
Well, when I first someone first asked me that, and I thought, yes, of course you can be your own teacher, because I believed in the idea of like being an autodidact and reading and reading and reading. But then as I wrote the book, I thought, no, the whole point of this book actually is that you can't be your own teacher, that part of what teaching is relation. And you get that from having the mirror of the other person. You get that from dialogue and exchange. And that is about finding another person to be your teacher.
Well, there are many, many teachers and mentors in here. Get the book, Lessons from My Teachers, from Preschool to the Present, to find out about many of these. I want to maybe end where we talked earlier in the book. What do you hope people take away from this?
I hope people remember their own teachers and with a sense of gratitude, whether they reach out to them or not. I hope they do. And I also came to this realization as I wrote the book that there's something about positioning yourself as a student and thinking, what am I learning from this, icky situation? Or conversely, what am I teaching? What am I modeling? What kind of behavior am I modeling in this situation? That those questions really help me recalibrate when I'm going through a difficult time. So, yeah, but I do hope people get a pen out or get an email out, track down their teachers and thank them.
Are you working on a play right now?
I'm desperate to write a new play. I'm working on two musicals. One is an adaptation of the book The Interestings by Meg Wolitzer, and Sarah Bareilles is doing the music. And the other is an adaptation of the children's book Wonder. And I hope I write a new play this summer.
Well, we'll look forward to all of that. In the meantime, people can go out and get the book. It's called Lessons from My Teachers. We've been talking with the author, playwright, essayist, and poet, Sarah Rule. You can find her at sarahruleplaywright.com. Sarah Rule, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for such a nice conversation and for such a profound reading of the book. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. We appreciate it. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.